Okay, let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service of the UN in Geneva. Today is Friday, 7th of November. We have a long list of speakers whom I thank in advance for being with us. And I'd like to start immediately with a colleague of the World Food Programme. Annabel Symington has brought us Cynthia Jones, who is the country director at interim for DRC. And I believe getting to us from Kinshasa to tell us about the latest food security situation in the DRC. So I'd like to give you the floor immediately. Please start with your introductory remarks. I don't know if Cynthia, you want to maybe to start, and then we give the floor to your colleague.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning to all. And on behalf of the World Food Programme team on the ground in the DRC, we're grateful for your time and everybody's time. As you said, I'm here to speak about the deepening hunger crisis that is unfolding in the East. What we have is the latest food security analysis report, the IPC, which has been released a few days ago. And it shows that the numbers of people that are facing emergency levels of hunger is surging. It has almost doubled since last year. And this has been driven by the various conflicts in Eastern DRC. And it demonstrates this major shift in the Eastern DRC context that we've experienced this year. An area the size of Switzerland has fallen under the de facto control of a non-state armed group known as the M23, which is called massive population movement, including large-scale forced returns of all of the displaced sites were broken up, and people were forced to return home with nothing, finding their houses destroyed, their fields looted, or being farmed by others. And new displacement continues as the fighting continues. Though people have been forced from their home over and over again, in the eastern part, there's about 5.2 million displaced people, including 1.6 million that have been displaced this year alone, making DRC one of the world's largest displaced person crises. Now, we couple that with all of these major disruptions at the setup of the de facto authority and the fall of Goma and Bukavu brought disruption to markets, national services like education, health, and the banking system. I mean, the banks are closed, there's no money available, and this has just had a major impact on the population and on the humanitarian response. And of course, it has devastated livelihoods and really put the food security of the affected people in dire, dire circumstances. So what does this mean in terms of the numbers and affected and the number of people that are in a dire need of life-saving food assistance? We have 1 in 3 people in Eastern DRC, so that's in North and South Kivu, Ituri, Tanganyika. This at this crisis and emergency level of food insecurity, what we know is IPC3 and IPC4, that's over 10 million people, if you can imagine that amount. However, of this, an alarming 3 million people are in that emergency category. And this means what for families? It means that they're skipping their meals, they've depleted all of their household assets, they're selling off their animals, their last goats. And as I said, this figure has doubled since the last one, since last year, last year's report. So the report a year ago. And coupled to that, malnutrition amongst children is alarmingly high. In some areas, reports are indicating that 60% of the children are malnourished. I myself have seen the difficult choices that women are making to feed themselves. I was also based out in Goma for about a year and a half as WFP's emergency coordinator. However, in spite of all of these challenges, population movements, humanitarian access issues, physical access issues, the poor roads, the rainy season, our teams on the ground have reached this year 3.4 million people with emergency life-saving food assistance. And that has been both in-kind food distribution and cash. We've also reached almost 1 million malnourished children and mothers through our nutrition program. However, as the hunger is deepening and getting worse, funding is running out, and we will only be able to support a fraction of those in need. We have been forced to cut our assistance greatly. In the lead up after the fall of Goma and the setup of the de facto authority, we've been able to reach about 1 million people per month. But since October, we've had to reduce that down to 600,000. And we need almost $350 million to be able to continue the emergency food and nutrition assistance in the next 6 months. Without it, we will have to make further cuts, reduce even further down to 300,000, reaching only 10% of the 3 million in need. And potentially by February, March, we may even have a complete break. So that is really the situation on the ground. What else is needed to help us, the partners, the humanitarian community respond is improved access. The two airports in the M23 areas have been closed basically since the end of January. And we're urgently calling for a humanitarian air corridor to be established. And so that is either for the partial reopening of the Goma airport to allow humanitarian flights only. And if this is too difficult and too challenging, there are also the options to consider cross-border flights from, Eastern DRC into airports close to the border in Rwanda. This is important because at a time when resources are going down, we need to be able to effectively and efficiently respond. And the opening and improving the air access into these areas would be a great enabler of this. So really, behind all of these stark statistics, the women, children, men, they've just been suffering devastating consequences of the violence perpetrated by the non-state armed groups and fleeing from conflict. They're tired, exhausted, and need peace. Let me be clear, we at WFP, we're doing all we can, but we can do more. And we ask for support to do more. In one of the world's largest hunger crises, largest displaced person crisis, and underneath it all, there is a protection crisis. So we're calling on donors, partners, international community, to assist and help the people of DRC and help bring some hope for them. So I'll stop there and back to you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia, and thanks also for the appeal to funds that would, unless given, really drag a terrible, even more terrible situation. So let me open now the floor to questions. Sorry, I see Olivia Reuters.
Good morning. Thank you for this briefing on DRC. Just wanted to clarify, you're saying there, sorry, just the audio was a little hard to hear. Did you say you would have to break food aid assistance by kind of between January and March next year if funding doesn't come through? And is that like a pause or is that a complete like stop? And if you could just clarify whether it's January or March or just the timescale would be helpful. And you're mentioning the $350 million figure. I mean, how much of that has been funded so far? And so I'm sure you did mention it, but I just wanted to check because you're talking about emergency food assistance, but also malnourished people. Did you have a figure there to hand on how many people currently under the latest IPC assessment are facing malnutrition? Thank you.
Cynthia?
Yes, thank you for your question. So what we've done is we're trying to stretch out the resources that we have. We're at historically low levels of funding. This is the we've probably received about $150 million this year on top of some of the resources that we had carried over from the year before. So we're at historically low funding levels. We're trying to stretch out our resources, and that comes with very challenging trade-offs, such as reducing further the number of people. We're talking about going down to 600,000 people per month. We could go down to 300,000 a month, let's say by December, January, to stretch this out further and further. But really, if we were even to continue reaching 600,000 people per month, we would break completely by February, March. That's the reality. That's how dire the situation is. We're starting to close down some offices. We're reducing our footprint, the number of staff, and juggling how to maintain the operational capacity to deliver in a very complex environment. So I think the last question was on the numbers of malnourished children, and mothers. It's got one of the highest numbers. There's about 5 million people facing malnourishment in the East.
Thank you. See, Olivia, I have a follow-up.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up. You're saying historically low levels. Just it would be helpful to have a figure of what you would usually have expected if this is historically low. Just something to compare to would be helpful of what kind of money you would normally have previously expected to receive for the need on the ground. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. Historically, I've been here since 2003. So in 2003, we got $600 million. And in 2024, it was about close to $400 million, closer to maybe $380 million. Adding that together, we've been operating at a level of about 400, being able to use well $400 million a year to reach the people in extreme levels of need. This year, we're in and around, we've only received $150 million that have been contributed to WFP this year.
A huge lower. Let me see if there are other questions for you, Cynthia. in the room or online. I don't see, but there is a note in the chat for you, Cynthia, from our correspondent of France 24, asking if it would be possible to send your notes as soon as possible to the journalists. Oh, I see that Catherine has put her hand up. So, Catherine, go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Alessandra, and good morning, Cynthia. Thank you for briefing us. Sorry, I came in a little bit late. Cynthia, how do you deal with the regions occupied by the Rwandese army, meaning the region of Goma? Are you active in the region? Are you able to see what's happening?
Yeah, Catherine, I think this was really the most of the briefing from Cynthia. I see that Annabelle is saying that she is sending out the notes now, but I don't know if, Cynthia, you want to add something to the question of Catherine? What you said before?
Yes. There was the takeover and the fall of Goma. Our teams never left. We downsized to emergency levels. All of our staff have returned, and we have maintained our operations both in North and South Kivu. We've got large teams on the ground both in Goma and Bukavu. We have some challenges to get in and out. Sometimes we work with OCHA, to negotiate humanitarian access and try to push back on any administrative requirements that the de facto authority is asking for. And really, it's the air access that is a very painful part. That right now we've got to fly from Kinshasa, which is 2,000 kilometers away, to either Addis or Nairobi, Kigali, go by road to get in. So we have been able to reach, despite the contested areas in North Kivu, quite effectively. South Kivu is a real challenge, essentially due to that's where a lot of the fighting is. The physical access is really difficult. And we've noted that the number of people in IPC4 in South Kivu has gone up seven times compared to last year. So it's gone up from about 135,000 people in that emergency, almost famine level, to just under over 900,000, 950,000. So this is really alarming because both of these provinces are divided. You've got two sets of authorities, the government and the de facto, just making cross-line access challenging and cross-border access challenging.
Thank you very much. And again, Annabelle, thanks for sending out the notes. Catherine?
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Cynthia, I know that previously most of the humanitarians, UN humanitarians and NGOs were, mentioned a certain way, were flying out or driving from Rwanda, Kigali, to Goma, which was very convenient and the shortest and the safest way. So now that you are, in fact, acting from Kinshasa, very far from the region, how would you qualify the impact of the occupation by the army of Rwanda and the fact that you don't use anymore the airport of Kigali? Does it mean that the Rwandese government did forbid you to have access to it? Or how come that you changed?
Let me explain something. I think you have, let me just kind of repeat and be clear. So Goma Airport was our humanitarian air hub. So if you were going from Kinshasa to the east, you would fly into Goma. As you know, WP, we run the humanitarian air service on behalf of partners. So that was our air hub. And you could fly to Goma, get to Bukavu, get to Beni, get to Bunia, all of the different provincial capitals in the east. Since the fall of Goma, that airport has been closed. It's been, some of the systems have been damaged. So that was our reality before the setup of the de facto authority situation. Now we have to fly around to different countries to get in. So for instance, to get into the southern part of South Kivu, we have to fly into Bujumbura and go by road to Uvira, which is an area that has rising emergency levels of food insecurity. We can fly to Beni, which is inside DRC, and we can drive cross line. It's possible, but it takes 2 to 3 days, two armored vehicles to be safe and such. And to go and come back, it's about $12,000. So going cross line inside DRC in North Kivu is possible, but it's risky, time consuming, expensive, and not effective. In South Kivu, between Bukavu and Uvira, it is not possible to drive. It's too much fighting, bad roads, and this is why we have to be able to access this eastern part through other, through the neighboring countries. I hope that clarifies.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. I think it's quite clear. I don't see other hands up for you, so we're waiting for your notes and hoping your appeal for funds will be heard very, very soon so you can continue your indispensable work. Thank you very much. Let's stay in Africa, and let me turn to my left. Eugene has brought us his colleague, Abdul Raouf Gnon Konde, who is the director of the Regional Bureau for Western Central Africa of UNHCR, and who's calling in from Nairobi, Eugene.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much, Alexandra. We are bringing, it's very rare occasion that we're bringing the good news that our director of Western Central Africa will talking about the voluntary repatriation, meaning that refugees in the region return home. So I'm glad to introduce our director of Western Central Africa, who will give you the picture of how the voluntary repatriation works and how it's one of the most favorable solution for displaced population. Over to you, director.
Thanks a lot, Eugene. Good morning to all of you. Imagine a refugee family who has spent years in a refugee camp, children growing up far from home, parents struggling to provide even the basics. But this year, Eugene, as you mentioned, more than 42,000 people like them have been able to return home voluntarily across the region, across the West and Central Africa region, bringing the total to over 272,000 since 2021. Most have returned to Nigeria and the Central African Republic, and another 10,000 are expected to go home before the year ends. For these families, returning home is more than crossing a border. It's about rebuilding a life, finding a safe home, access to land, schools for children, and the hope that comes with stability. UNHCR surveys show that more than 80,000 of Central African refugees living in Cameroon and Chad are ready to go home as soon as these conditions are met. Next year, we aim to help 60,000 people to go back to the Central African Republic as part of a big plan to bring back home 300,000 Central African refugees in the coming years. But progress like this is only possible because government and communities are working together. Early this year, in January, agreement with Chad and Nigeria has helped make returns safe and dignified. Talks are also advancing with Niger. In the Great Lakes, as we just heard from DRC situation, renewed peace commitment between Congo DRC and Rwanda mean that more returns there will remain voluntary and safe. But this kind of progress is very fragile. Without urgent and sustained funding, this return could stall, leaving millions, thousand families, refugee families, stuck in camp or in asylum countries. UNHCR is calling for flexible, multi-year support to make sure these returns are not just a journey home, but a true new beginning. Once the families are back home, it means children can then go back to school and communities can then recover with hope and dignity. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Director. Thank you for this. And I see that our correspondent of the German News Agency has a question. Christiane.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the briefing. Could you give us an idea? First of all, can you share your notes? Because there were so many figures in it. But can you give us an idea of how this compares to other years? Was it a especially successful year? Or do you return people to the tune of the same numbers every year? Thank you very much.
No, I thank you for the question. Last year, if you take 2024, we have seen 19,000 return, refugee return in the region. So compared to the 40,000 that I have just indicated, plus the 10,000 that we could get by the end of the year. So it means that we are not at that scale. But there are reasons for that. Because first, we have elections, presidential election coming very soon in December in Central Africa. And we know by experience that when there are elections, then refugees are a bit hesitant. They want to wait and see and make sure that because of election, we don't have a renewed violence. So that is maybe probably one of the reasons. If I also take maybe IDPs, last year we had like close to 251,000 IDPs who have returned home. And this year we see an increased number of IDPs going back home. But our concerns, if I can put it that way, is still how do we make those returns sustainably? How do we ensure that when people go back home, they go back home and they can have access to renew access to services, they have access to administration services, they have access to documentation. So how do we make it sustainable, those returns? So those are the big challenges. But you're absolutely right, in a nutshell, return was not at the same pace as we have seen it in the previous years.
And Christian, I see that the notes are already in our mailboxes.
And
so you
in
should
the
have
notes
it.
There is the number for 2024, because I didn't get that.
The number for 2024, 90,000 refugees were able to go back home. And for the IDPs, close to 251,000 IDPs were also able to go back home.
Well noted. Thank you very much. Other questions to UNHCR? I don't see hands up. So thank you very much. But before I let you go, first of all, thank you very much to Abderrahouf Gnonkonde to come and brief the journalist. And Eugene, before I let you go, you have an announcement?
Yeah, just a quick announcement. I know that you already received our media advisory on the COP30. As COP30 is approaching next week, just to inform you that our High Commissioner, Filippo Grandi, will attend the COP30, which is his last one, because it's his last year. And then he will have conference on 10th of November, 2:30 p.m. local time, which I think it's 4 hours behind us. It's going to be live streamed, and then you can find the link on the media advisory, and then PR, press release, and then embargoed press release and then report will be shared today. I promise it will land yesterday, but I will promise you again that it will land today. Sorry for that. And also that you will have a link to the B-roll and a photo as well. Thank you.
It happens. And that gives me the opportunity to remind you that the Secretary General is still in Belém for the Climate Summit, and he will speak today at two thematic sessions. One, the Energy Transition Roundtable, and the other one, he will pronounce remarks at the COP30 thematic session titled 10 Years of the Paris Agreement, Nationally Determined Contributions and Financing. And we will, of course, share his remarks with you. So thank you very much, Eugene. And let me now turn to OHCHR. We have not one, but two spokespersons today. Tamin is with me on the podium to tell us about Syria. And I think Saif is online. Let me see. Yes, I can see him. From Nairobi to talk about Niger. So I don't know who wants to start.
As you wish, I can start.
Whatever. Okay, let's start. Let's start with Tamin. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. 11 months since the fall of the former government in Syria, we continue to receive worrying reports about dozens of abductions and enforced disappearances, in addition to the more than 100,000 people who went missing under the Assad regime. Since the fall of Assad, some families have been reunited with their loved ones, while many still live with the distress of not knowing where they are or what happened to them. The fate and whereabouts of all those who have gone missing, both before and after the fall of the former government, must urgently be clarified. In this regard, we support the work of the Independent Institution on Missing Persons in the Syrian Arab Republic. One recent emblematic case is the disappearance of the Syria Civil Defense volunteer, Hamza Al-Ammarin, who went missing on the 16th of July, 2025, while supporting a humanitarian evacuation mission during violence in Suweida. He remains unaccounted for. We stress that all armed actors, both exercising state power and otherwise, must respect and protect humanitarian workers at all times, everywhere, as required by international human rights law and applicable humanitarian law. Accountability and justice for all human rights violations and abuses, past and present, are essential for Syria to build a durable, peaceful, and secure future for all its people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I see. Yes, please. Bonjour, Moussa.
Bonjour et merci, Alessandra. Après quelques mois de ce qui s'est passé à Suweida et au Sahel, donc les côtes syriennes, est-ce qu'aujourd'hui vous avez une image claire de nombre de morts, de victimes dans les deux régions? Et qu'est-ce qui s'est passé? Donc vous qualifiez en quoi ce qui s'est passé dans ces deux régions? Merci.
Merci pour cette question, Moussa. Comme on l'a dit dès le début, ce qui s'est passé, ce sont des événements atroces, des horribles crimes contre des civils dans les deux régions. Et cela souligne l'importance pour que la Syrie ait une procédure et un processus de justice, de responsabilité judiciaire pour tous les crimes, pour toutes les violations, celles commises avant et après la chute de l'ancien régime. En ce qui concerne les chiffres, nous avons quelques chiffres. Déjà, depuis le début de l'année, depuis janvier 2025, au moins 929 personnes ont été tuées en Syrie. Et ce sont des chiffres qu'on a pu vérifier. Cela inclut 410 personnes dont la mort a été vérifiée entre le 6 et le 10 mars dans les événements de violence dans la région côtière. Et 206 personnes qui ont été tuées entre le 12 et le 19 juillet à Soueïda. Il est très important de noter que ce sont des chiffres qui ont été vérifiés par nos équipes sur place. Nous pensons que le vrai nombre de personnes qui ont été tuées est bien plus élevé que cela. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Alors, Olivia ?
Thank you, Thamine. Could you just outline some of the challenges that you're facing and people on the ground are facing in terms of actually then trying to track what happens to their loved ones? And also any kind of idea about why this is still happening? We're very familiar with what happened under the Assad regime, but is that linked into communal violence or retribution? Or yes, just any idea of why this is happening still? Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that, Olivia. Obviously, the security situation is very volatile since the change of government in Syria. And there are many parties and factions who are trying to grab power or who are still at conflict with each other. One of the main challenges for our office is that, especially when we're talking about abductions and disappearances, is that people are frightened to speak. Some people have said that they have been threatened if they would speak to us. Sometimes we obviously manage to document cases of abductions. In fact, we have managed to document at least 97 people who have been abducted since January 2025. But of course, many people do not report these cases to us because they are afraid of what would happen to their loved ones. Also, we know that several abducted individuals have been released, but this might not have been reported to our office because people are still afraid for their loved ones. So basically, it is very difficult for us to determine a real figure of how many people are in a situation of abduction or enforced disappearance at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In the room, I've got more, but if you have a follow-up, go ahead. Et puis, je vais à la...
Oui. Juste une question concernant les disparus. Est-ce que vous avez une idée de combien de personnes disparues en Syrie depuis le chute de l'ancien régime? Merci.
Merci, Moussa. Comme je viens de préciser, depuis le début de janvier 2025, au moins 97 personnes excusez-moi, ont été soit kidnappées, soit disparues par des auteurs non identifiés. Et ça, c'est un chiffre qui a été documenté par notre bureau. Mais c'est à prendre avec beaucoup de pincettes parce que, comme je viens de préciser, d'abord, il y a des cas qui peuvent ne pas être rapportés à notre équipe. Aussi, parfois, certaines personnes qui ont été kidnappées pourraient avoir été libérées sans qu'on le sache parce que leurs familles sont, pour des raisons complètement compréhensibles, sont horrifiées, ils ont peur de ce qui pourrait leur arriver si jamais ils se mettent en contact avec nos équipes. Donc il y a un climat de peur qui règne et ce climat fait partie des défis qui sont qui empêchent nos équipes d'avoir des informations claires parfois ou des chiffres précis.
Merci beaucoup. Laurent, tu le zoomes?
Yeah. Thanks, Tamin, for the briefing. A few follow-up questions. First, about the trend. So, would you say that we still observe every month abductions and disappearances, or is it just around big violences like the one in the coastal areas or the one in Ceuta, or is it a more regular pattern? That's the first one. You mentioned that a few people could be reunited with the close one. How many people, nearly, roughly, are we talking about? Single digit, dozens of people, hundreds of people? And finally, do you already see any concrete effect of the new institution as a game changer in that regard? Thank you.
Thank you for that. First of all, we are talking about dozens of people who have been abducted. It is very difficult, for the reasons I mentioned, to know exactly how many, or even to have an estimation of how many have been released. We know that some have been released, but it's very difficult to have a figure. I can check again with my colleagues and get back to you if we have more on that. On the institution for missing persons, it is a very important institution that our office took part in its foundation, in its launch process, and it had been planned for even before the fall of the Assad regime. What happened is that when the Assad regime ended, the teams of the institution had to work even more and quicker to put the whole process in place. Obviously, it's a very challenging process. You can ask the teams, our colleagues at the institution, who have started their work, of course. And I imagine they are having a lot of work, especially with all what's going on in Syria today. So this is why it is crucial to support the work of this institution and for the authorities also to cooperate with the mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Laurent, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, sorry about that. There was just a question also about whether there is a regular trend throughout the month or whether these new disappearances are only related to big events like the coastal areas and Sweden.
Yes, sorry, I missed that. Of course, we can imagine that many of the abduction cases occur during violence events, such as the ones that happened on the coastal areas and in Ceuta. But we still receive reports of abductions happening up until the present time in Syria. So I do not have an exact timeline of that. I can also check with my colleagues if necessary, but what I know is that we are still receiving reports of abductions going on in Syria.
Thank you very much, Remy.
Merci, Alexandra. Bonjour, Tamin. Savoir, pas sur les chiffres, j'ai bien compris que tu n'en avais pas forcément des très précis. En revanche, demander des précisions peut-être sur les lieux où est-ce que vous voyez le plus de ces événements. Est-ce que toutes les régions sont concernées? Est-ce qu'on est plus sur la région côtière, la région de Ceuta, la côte alaouite, sur les personnes qui sont aussi enlevées? Est-ce que là aussi, il y a des sortes de patterns qui se diront, c'est confirmé qu'il y a, par exemple, les enlèvements concernent plus la minorité alaouite, par exemple.
Jérémy, on t'entend vraiment très, très, très mal.
Ok, est-ce que là, c'est un peu mieux?
Essaye.
J'essaie de parler près du micro, est-ce que tu m'entends mieux?
Vas-y, j'ai l'impression que oui, mais on va écouter.
Ok, j'ai essayé. La question était très simple, ce n'était pas sur les chiffres, mais sur le pattern. Est-ce qu'on voit plus d'enlèvements dans les régions côtières, les régions à la 8? Est-ce que ça concerne certaines minorités? Voilà. Est-ce qu'il y a des choses qui se dégagent au-delà des chiffres qui sont très difficiles à avoir? Est-ce qu'on arrive à dire que ça concerne certaines régions et certaines minorités?
Oui, merci Jérémy. En effet, il y a eu des enlèvements dans la région côtière. Il y a eu des enlèvements à Soueïda, dans le gouvernorat de Soueïda. Mais pas que. Cela peut arriver partout en Syrie, là où il y a un climat de manque de sécurité. Et donc, les motivations derrière ces actes peuvent être sectaires, parfois, et donc viser certaines communautés comme les Alaouites, les Druzes, mais pas que. Il y a aussi des raisons qui peuvent parfois être financières, comme enlever quelqu'un pour demander des rançons. Nous avons eu des rapports qui font état de certains cas où des femmes peuvent fuir avec un amant. Cela n'est pas évidemment pas que il n'y a pas que ces cas-là, parce que aussi ça concernait des hommes, des femmes avec des enfants. On ne peut pas réduire cela à des fuites avec des amants, évidemment. Il y a aussi des cas où des femmes pourraient fuir fuir de la violence domestique. Donc dans une situation de manque de sécurité un peu généralisée dans le pays, cela peut arriver n'importe où.
Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup, Tamine. Don't see other questions for you. So stay on the podium, please, and I'll give the floor now to your colleague in Nairobi. Say if you have the floor. And you are telling us about Niger.
Yes, indeed, that is right. Good morning, everyone. You will already have received this statement. The arrests of at least 13 journalists in Niger over the past year on allegations of defamation, undermining national security, and conspiracy against the state authority under the revised criminal cybercrime law are very worrying. The revised law was adopted in June last year. Six journalists were arrested on the 1st of November, among them Moussa Kaka, the director of Radio Television Sarunia. Ibro Kaka and others were subsequently released on bail, but three others, Ibro Chaibu, Yusuf Seriba, and Umaru Kane, from other local media outlets, remain in custody to date. All six are accused of vague charges of complicity in the dissemination of information likely to disturb public order. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, calls on the authorities to release all the journalists still being held and to discontinue all proceedings that exceed the strict bounds set out under international human rights law. More generally, the authorities should take steps to review the cybercrime law and ensure its full alignment with international human rights law, in particular Article 19 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees the rights to freedom of opinion and expression. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Saif. Any question on Niger and the work of journalists? Don't see any hand up on the platform either. Thank you very much, Saif, for spotlighting this. It's really an important plea. But I know Kuna had a question for any of you, actually, who wanted to take it. I think it's on Gaza, right?
Yes, thank you so much, Alessandra. Thank you, Femin. Yes, I have actually three questions on Gaza. The first one about the international stabilization forces from in the US plan on Gaza. Do you think that this, do you have any comment on that and if that comply with the international law or not? And the second thing is about the airstrike that the occupation forces carried out this morning in Khan Yunis and in Gaza City. And this also systematic demolition of building behind the yellow line, if you have any comment on that. And the last question about the West Bank, if you noticed an increase of the attack of settlers after the ceasefire, and if you have any figures in victims in West Bank and in Gaza after the ceasefire. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Iman. First of all, I'm sorry if I'll miss any question, you'll remind me. On the suggested force to stabilize the situation in Gaza, any force that works, operates, or will work or operate in the future must respect international law and international humanitarian law. Also, it is very important that in any sort of process for the future of Gaza and the whole occupied Palestinian territory, that the Palestinian people are involved, and that the right of the Palestinians to self-determination is respected. On the strikes that have happened since the ceasefire, we have noticed a number of airstrikes, and I would like to be clear on something. First of all, our office does not monitor the compliance of different parties with the ceasefire agreement per se. Whether there is a ceasefire or not, international humanitarian law and international human rights law must be respected, and civilians must be protected, and human rights of people, of Palestinians in Gaza, do not change, whether there is a ceasefire or not. Of course, we call on everyone to respect the ceasefire. This is something we have been calling for since day one. The ceasefire is needed, and it's crucial, and it must be respected. But in any way, in any military operation, civilians must be protected. When it comes to the West Bank, attacks by settlers are continuing, unfortunately. We have verified that since the 7th of October, 2023, and as of the 5th of November, 2025, Israeli security forces and settlers killed 1,010 Palestinians in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. And this figure includes 215 children. The attacks have been increasing. We have seen that recently, especially with the olive harvest season. These must stop, and there must be accountability. I can also give you a figure of 757 attacks recorded in the first half of 2025 alone, which is a 13% higher figure than the same period last year. So this must stop, and there must be accountability for settlers and for members of Israeli security forces who are involved in these attacks. And of course, we refer back to the ruling by the International Court of Justice that it's very crucial for the unlawful Israeli presence in the occupied Palestinian territory to end. Thank you.
Yeah, and I would like to just add that, as we have said on several occasions, the West Bank is on a dangerous trajectory that, if not reversed, will make the two-state solution impossible, physically impossible. The Secretary General has been calling regularly for an urgent de-escalation of these unilateral actions that Tamim was referring to, including settlement expansion and violence against civilians. And he has asked for stopping this expansion and calls for annexation, which would constitute a most serious violation of international law. And I would also like to call your attention to the statement on the West Bank that Tom Fletcher made on the 4th of November, also calling for the end of these attacks. Thank you. Okay, I don't see other hands up for UNHCR. Thank you very much. Let me see, just sorry. I want to just have a look at the platform. No, there are none. So thanks a lot to both colleagues, Saif and Tamim. On my left, we go to UNICEF. Carl, do you have an update on Melissa?
Yes, but before I go to Melissa, just to add on the West Bank, we know that just this year, 47 children were killed. So. In 2025 in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. So, again, just to reinforce that whatever is happening in Gaza, the horrors of the war in Gaza that have been enduring for 2 years, and now we have a very fragile ceasefire, which has been somewhat disrespected over the past 2 weeks, including with children being killed very rapidly in a period of 24 hours, reportedly. Whatever is happening there cannot allow the West Bank to be background noise. It's very serious what's happening there. Children have been dying since the war started, and again, just this year, 47 children have been killed, including in East Jerusalem. And as my colleague said, and Alessandro reinforced, this also needs to end, and international law must be respected, and children must always be protected, civilians and the infrastructure they rely on. So let me go quickly now to Hurricane Melissa. I know it's been a long briefing. I'll try and go as quickly as possible. We know that it has now been 1 week since Hurricane Melissa tore through the Caribbean, leaving behind a path of destruction across Jamaica, Cuba, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. 1 week on, thousands of children still lack safe water, health care, schooling, and protection. UNICEF will continue working with governments and partners to meet their most urgent needs and to help every child recover and rebuild their future after this horrible disaster. Across these four countries, more than 900,000 children now have been impacted. So that's an addition to the previous figure we had. It doesn't mean they are at immediate risk, but they do need immediate support. And at least 679,000 children are now in urgent humanitarian need. Our teams are on the ground, as I mentioned. And let me just go specifically on each country. In Jamaica, where the hurricane made landfall at Category 5 storm, 281,000 children need urgent help. Major hospitals have been destroyed or partially damaged, and communities remain flooded. UNICEF has dispatched 6 tons of wash and medical supplies, including 12,500 dignity kits and 24,000 water containers. And we are also supporting the government to restore health, nutrition, and education services in Cuba. Even more, 441,000 children are affected, over 1,500 schools and 287 health centers have sustained damage. UNICEF has delivered water purification plants, hygiene kits, and tarpaulins, and is working on reestablishing clean water and structuring and schooling infrastructure. In Haiti, again, a country that has been plagued with violence for many years now, caused by armed groups, the hurricane claimed 31 lives, including 10 children, and destroyed or damaged over 16,000 homes. UNICEF is coordinating the WASH Nutrition and Education and Child Protection response, providing hygiene kits for 14,500 people, cash assistance, which is very important on the social protection front, for 8,000 children and 8,000 households, I beg your pardon, and psychosocial support to affected children and caregivers. Haiti is a very specific case in this disaster because, as I said, it's been facing or plagued with violence for many years now, and it's one of the fastest growing displacement crises for children anywhere in the world. In just 1 year, in the past 12 months, the number of displaced children has nearly doubled, and it's now at around 680,000 children. That was previous to Hurricane Melissa. Every one of them has either lost their homes, their routine, and their sense of safety. So their childhood is literally impacted for an undetermined period of time. Each displacement event carries a heavy toll. Children lose their homes again, their education opportunities, their safety and their protection. Armed groups in Haiti now control over 85% of Port-au-Prince, the capital, and key transport routes. So whatever is happening now after Hurricane Melissa just increased their suffering and the urgent need for support. We have reports of many of them saying they can no longer sleep through the night because they either hear gunfire, they fear being taken, they fear never going back to school. And now, again, after this natural disaster, their lives are even more upheld by the unpredictable impacts that violence combined with climate disasters can bring. And again, just finally, the Dominican Republic, the last country that I wanted to share updates, operational, 62,000 children were affected by severe flooding, and we are distributing, again, hygiene kits and supporting health and nutrition services for 20,000 children and caregivers, and we are asking again, we're appealing for $56 million for our response, and there are still significant gaps to that amount. I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse my cold. Okay, so let's see. Questions in the room? Don't see any. Antonio?
Thank you. Only because you said there is gaps on the response, can you be more specific on how much money is still lacking?
So these assessments are still ongoing, and for the time being, we can say that the gap is significant, but I don't have any specific figure. But surely it's way below the expected and urgently required amount.
Other questions to UNICEF? Don't see any, Ricardo. Thank you very much. And we are now going to our last, but definitely not least, speaker, who's Christian. Christian, you have two announcements. Oh, sorry. Just one thing before you go. Antonio's saying, you know, just if you can send your notes. Thank you. Christian.
Thank you very much, Alessandra, and hi, everyone. Yeah, two brief announcements for next week from my side. For Tuesday, 11 November, we have the WHO press conference, a virtual press conference for the launch of the 2025 Global Tuberculosis Report. The time is not exactly fixed yet. There will be a media advisory coming out later today. It should be either 2:30 or 3:30 in the afternoon. The report features data on disease trends and the response to the epidemic from 184 countries and areas with more than 99% of the world's population TB burden. It provides a comprehensive and up-to-date assessment of the TB epidemic, progress in the response at global, regional, and country levels, as well as the impact of the recent funding cuts and the drivers of the TB epidemic. That is Tuesday, 11 November, time to be specified. Second, that's an announcement for our colleagues from the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the WHO FCTC. They will have their Conference of the Parties starting on 17 November. So that's another COP, not to be confused. And the opening press conference for this one, for the WHO FCTC conference of the parties and meeting of the parties, two separate events after each other, will be on Thursday, 13 November at 1500 hours, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Representatives from the parties will meet in Geneva over the next, the following 2 weeks to discuss tobacco control measures under the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control and the protocol to eliminate illicit trade in tobacco products. The COP is the governing body of the WHO FCTC, and this 11th session will be held in Geneva, 17 to 22 November. And the follow-up is the meeting of the parties to the protocol to eliminate illicit trade in tobacco products. And that's the governing body to the protocol. And this, the fourth session will take place 24 to 26 November. The speakers during the press conference will share what will be expected during the COP and the MOP and the key media moments. Connection details to join will be sent with the media advisory early next week, I assume. Contacts for the FCTC is in one word, mediafctc@who.int. mediafctc@who.int. Thanks.
Christian, let me see if there are questions. There is one question here. That is if the journalists accredited to the Palais can use their badge to go to the COP.
Attendance at the COP will not be possible, but please details on that one, because it's the COP is always a very reglemented story with attendance. So no, there was an advisory earlier to how to register and accredit for the COP. Please get in touch with mediafctc@who.int.
Thank you. Antonio?
Just to clarify our agenda, the press conference on the tuberculosis report is the same day that the report is released, or is a conference under embargo?
Ah, good point. No, the report is embargoed until that very moment, so until the beginning of the press conference. An embargoed copy, and thank you very much for reminding me, Antonio, an embargoed copy of the report will be available 24 hours in advance. So by Monday noon, we should expect to have the embargo reports to be shared. We will send details in the media advisory how to get that report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions for WHO? No? Christian, thank you so much. So, few announcements for you. Since we are speaking about press conferences, let me remind you the press conference on Monday, 10th of November at 10:30. This is the Minamata Convention on Mercury. There is a new speaker which has been added to the list. So, in addition to the Executive Secretary of the Minamata Convention and the Senior Coordinator Officer, we will have the Legal Officer of the Convention. They will tell you about the major outcome of the sixth meeting of the Conference of the Parties, and that, as I said, will be on Monday at 10:30. Meeting updates, I've been asked, so we have the the Committee Against Torture, which is opening next Monday, 10th November at 10 a.m. This is their 83rd session at Palais Wilson from 10 to 28 of November. The countries to be reviewed are Israel, Argentina, Bahrain, and Albania. Israel will be reviewed 11 November in the morning and 12 in the afternoon. Argentina, 12 in the morning and 13 in the afternoon. Bahrain, morning of the 18th and afternoon the 19th. And Albania, morning of the 19th and afternoon of the 20th. You also know, because I think you have received yesterday the press release, that the United Nations Human Rights Council will hold a special session on the human rights situation in and around El Fasher in the context of the ongoing conflict in Sudan, and that will be on Friday, 14th of November. The special session will probably start quite early at 9 a.m. in the Assembly Hall of the Palais des Nations. It will be webcast live by UNIS Geneva in the six official languages of the UN. The special session is being convened per an official request submitted on Wednesday afternoon, 5th November, by the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, jointly with Germany, Ireland, Netherlands, Norway, and supported by 24 member states. States Member of the Council. You have the list of the signatories, more details in the press release you have received. Let me also give you two other information. I know it's also a little bit early, but we would like to invite you all to the opening of this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. The theme of this year is Unite to End Digital Violence Against All Women and Girls. The opening will be on the 25th of November here at the Palais des Nations. We'll have a beautiful activation in the Hall 14 at 12:30. And this is organized by UNOG together with the EU delegation and UN Women. And because we're speaking about bullying and online, just to remind you that today it is International Day Against Violence and Bullying at School, including cyberbullying. This is not taken, it's one of those days where the leads is with another agency. This particular one is UNESCO. I just wanted to let you know that the UNESCO colleagues are organizing a symposium which will be live webcast entitled Connected, Protected and Empowered, Ending Online and Tech-Facilitated Violence so that all learners can thrive. On the UNESCO website, you will find the webcast. I think it's important to remind that this is really concerning all of us and our children. And yeah, that's it. I think I've told you everything. Let me see if there are any questions to me. I don't see any, so thank you very much. Thanks for following the briefing, and all weekend. I'll see you on Tuesday. Thanks.